This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wisdom Sits in Places, Landscape and Language Among the Western Apache, by Keith H. Basso, narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. Western Apache Pronunciation Guide. The Western Apache language contains four vowels: A, as in father; E, as in red; E, as in police; and O, as in go, varying towards U, as in two. All four vowels can be pronounced short or long depending on duration of sound. Vowel length is indicated typographically by double letters. For example, AA pronounced ah. Each of the vowels can be nasalized, which is indicated by a subscript hook under the vowel. For example, a hook under an A pronounced uh, and a hook under a double A pronounced uh. When one pronounces a nasalized vowel, air passes through the nasal passage so as to give the vowel a soft, slightly ringing sound. The four Western Apache vowels can be pronounced with high or low tone. High tone is indicated by an accent mark over the vowel. For example, an accent mark over an A pronounced ah, showing that the vowel is pronounced with a rising pitch. In certain instances, the consonant N with an accent mark is also spoken with high tone. Western Apache contains approximately 31 consonants and consonant clusters. 15 of them are pronounced approximately as in English: B, CH, D, H, J, K, L, M, N, S, SH, T, W, Y, Z. Another consonant in Western Apache is the glottal stop, indicated by the symbol of a single closed quote. The glottal stop can occur before and after all four vowels and after certain consonants and consonant clusters, produced by closure of the glottis so as to momentarily halt air passing through the mouth. The glottal stop resembles the interruption of breath one hears between the two O's in the English expression uh-oh. The glottalized consonants and consonant clusters in Western Apache are K, T, CH, T silent L, and TS. Other consonants and consonant clusters are DL, as in the final syllable of paddling, DZ, as in the final sound of ads, G, as in get, never, as in gentle, GH, similar to G, but pronounced farther back in the mouth. This consonant often sounds like a guttural W. HW, as in what, KW, as in quick. The silent L has no counterpart in English. The mouth is shaped for an L, but the vocal cords are not used. The sound is made by expelling air from both sides of the tongue. T silent L, as in tingit. TS, as in the final sound of pots. ZH, as in azure. Preface. What do people make of places? The question is as old as people and places themselves, as old as human attachments to portions of the earth, as old perhaps as the idea of home, of our territory as opposed to their territory, of entire regions and local landscapes where groups of men and women have invested themselves, their thoughts, their values, their collective sensibilities, and to which they feel they belong. The question is as old as a strong sense of place, and the answer, if there is one, is every bit as complex. Sense of place complex? We tend not to think so, mainly because our attachments to places, like the ease with which we usually sustain them, are unthinkingly taken for granted. As normally experienced, sense of place quite simply is, as natural and straightforward as our fondness for certain colors and culinary tastes and the thought that it might be complicated or even very interesting, seldom crosses our minds. Until, as sometimes happens, we are deprived of these attachments and find ourselves adrift, literally dislocated, in unfamiliar surroundings we do not comprehend and care for even less. On these unnerving occasions, sense of place may assert itself in pressing and powerful ways, and its often subtle components, as subtle perhaps as absent smells in the air or not enough visible sky, come surging into awareness. It is then we come to see that attachments to places may be nothing less than profound, and that when these attachments are threatened, we may feel threatened as well. Places, we realize, are as much a part of us as we are part of them, and senses of place, yours, mine, and everyone else's, partake complexly of both. And so, unavoidably, senses of place also partake of cultures, of shared bodies of local knowledge, the phrase is Clifford Geertz's, with which persons and whole communities render their places meaningful and endow them with social importance. Yet cultural anthropologists, some of whom work for years in communities where ties to place are vital and deep-seated, have not until recently had much to say about them. Places, to be sure, are frequently mentioned in anthropological texts. The people of X, the hamlet of Y, the marketplace at Z. But largely in passing, typically early on and chiefly as a means of locating the texts themselves, grounding them, as it were, in settings around the world. And with that task accomplished, the texts move ahead, with scarcely a backward glance, to take up other matters. Practicing ethnographers, much like everyone else, take senses of place for granted, and ethnographic studies exploring their cultural and social dimensions are in notably short supply. Human attachments to places, as various and diverse as the places to which they attach, remain in their way an enigma. Some 15 years ago, a weathered ethnographer linguist with 2 decades of fieldwork in a village of Western Apaches already behind me, I stumbled onto places there. A curious way of speaking, I know, but that is just how it felt, and became aware of their considerable fascination for the people whose places they are. I had first gone to Cibicue in the summer of 1959 as a 19-year-old college student. I was captivated by Cibicue and almost everything about it, and in the years that followed, having completed graduate school, I wrote articles and monographs on such subjects as Apache ceremonial symbolism, classificatory verb stems, witchcraft beliefs, patterns of silence in social interaction, and a sardonic type of joking in which Apaches imitate white men. In between projects, no matter how captivated, you can't do anthropology all the time. I also learned to cowboy, camping and riding for weeks at a time, with horsemen from Cibicue who were masters of the trade. In both anthropology and cowboying, I sometimes came up short, though not so much as to be wildly embarrassed, and when the essay on joking was done, I began to look around for something new to do. The answer came from Ronnie Lupe, chairman of the White Mountain Apache tribe, A keenly intelligent man with a splendid gift for his own Apache language and an abiding interest in Cibicu, where he was born and raised. "Why don't you make maps over there?" the chairman suggested firmly in his office at White River one day. "Not white men's maps, we've got plenty of them, but Apache maps, with Apache places and names. We could use them. Find out something about how we know our country. You should have done this before." Mr. Lupe's suggestion, or was it a directive, appealed to me at once, and a few days later, having discussed it at length with some of my friends in Cibicu, I informed him that I was prepared to begin. A year later, supported by a grant from the National Science Foundation, the project got underway. Basically, the project had three parts: traveling with Apache consultants, many of whom were active or retired horsemen, to hundreds of named localities in the greater Cibicu region, talking with consultants, frequently at their homes, about places and place names and the stories that lie behind them, and listening with a newly sensitized ear to how place names get used in daily conversation by Apache men and women. The project continued for almost 18 months, spread over 5 years, 1979 to 1984, and this book is one of the results. It contains none of the maps we made. Chairman Lupe has determined that publishing these would be unwise. But places and place names, and something of what Apaches make of both, is what it is mainly about. Mainly, I say, because Apache constructions of place reach deeply into other cultural spheres, including conceptions of wisdom, notions of morality, politeness, and tact in forms of spoken discourse, and certain conventional ways of imagining and interpreting the Apache tribal past. For this and other reasons, the chapters of this book, all of which were written as independent essays, approach its central topic from somewhat different perspectives, offering as they do complementary takes on the significance of places in Apache thought and practice. The listener will also find that each chapter is centered on a different Apache person, not only because he or she figured centrally in my work, but also because senses of place, while always informed by bodies of local knowledge, are finally the possessions of particular individuals. People, not cultures, sense places. And I have tried to suggest that in Cibicu, as elsewhere, they do so in varying ways. A book as short as this should not have taken so long to write. One of the reasons it did is that the experience of place, or as Ronnie Lupe said, how people know their country, is in anthropology and the social sciences generally lightly charted territory. There are few intellectual maps for ethnographers to follow, and therefore they are obliged to fashion them for themselves. But where does one turn for direction and helpful ideas? The answer, of course, is wherever one chooses to turn, or, as Johnson remarked to Boswell, wherever things look bright. I turned for brightness to an assortment of modern philosophers: Sartre, Heidegger, Nelson Goodman, Merleau-Ponty, Edward Casey. Historians: L.P. Hartley, William David Chapman, Lowenthal. Novelists and poets with a strong sense of place: Faulkner, Welty, Stegner, Cormac McCarthy, Larry McMurtry, T.S. Eliot, Heaney. Writers on nature: Dillard, Ehrlich, Lopez, McPhee, a very perceptive physicist, Niels Bohr, and since I was dealing with American Indians, two pertinent works by N. Scott Momaday, Vine Deloria Jr., Leslie Silko, Alfonso Ortiz, and other Indian authors. I have drawn, thankfully, though not always obviously, from all these sources and more, as I have from the incisive anthropology of Clifford Geertz, who continues to do it in his way, the eccentric sociology of Irving Goffman, who emphatically did it his, and the sensitive sociolinguistics of Del Himes, who thrives on the complexities of Native American languages and likewise steers his own distinctive course. Dudley Patterson, a Cibecue horseman, once said to me after a long day's ride searching for cattle in broken country, "Not many cows, but many good places. Try to hold on to them. It's good. You could learn a lot." I did try. I have learned, and I hope that those who thrive on attachments to places will find value in this account of how others do the same. In this convulsive age of uprooted populations and extensive diasporas, holding on to places and sensing fully the goodness contained therein has become increasingly difficult, and in years to come, I expect, it may everywhere be regarded as a privilege and a gift. American Indians, who settled this continent first and were the first to be displaced, understand this already in very pervasive ways. May we all learn from them, and, as Western Apaches say in prayer and regular talk, may it soon be usefully so. And may I, on that graceful note, conclude by thanking some very generous people who shared their ideas on place with me and commented on my work. Vine Deloria Jr., N. Scott Momaday, Jerry Flute, Gail Porter Basso, Karen Blue, Dan Frank, Michael Graves, Philip Greenfeld, Bill Douglas, Morris Foster, Edward Casey, Stephen Feld, Nancy Munn, Alfonso Ortiz, Del Himes, Virginia Himes, Richard Bauman, Joel Scherzer, Charles Frake, Roy D'Andrani, Harold Conklin, Clifford Geertz, Stephen Murray, James Carey, Eugene Hun, Michael Silverstein, Thomas Thornton, Larry Evers, Katie Stewart, Miriam Kahn, Rachel Hadass, Sue Allen Mills, Alan Wilson, Julie Cruikshank, William Hanks, Scott Rushforth, Peter Whiteley, Jane Kep, Ray McDermott, George Marcus, Stephen Tyler, the late Sir Edmund Leach, and Elizabeth Hadass, director of the University of New Mexico Press. The standard disclaimers apply. Much of my fieldwork in Cibecue was made possible by grants from the National Science Foundation and the Werner Gren Foundation for Anthropological Research. I am grateful to these organizations for their confidence and support. I would also like to acknowledge the American Anthropological Association for permission to make use of previously published material. June L. Piper prepared the final manuscript with grace, expertise, and many helpful suggestions. Finally, I wish to thank the University of New Mexico for granting me a sabbatical leave in order to finish this book, and my colleagues in the Department of Anthropology for respecting it so cheerfully. My debt to the Apache people of Cibecue, which now reaches back more than 35 years, is enormous and profound. No one could ask for better teachers or finer friends than horsemen Morley Cromwell, Charles Henry, Robert Macuse, Nick Thompson, and Dudley Patterson. Although all are with their ancestors now, I know they are still on hand, for I hear their voices often as I travel through their country. How deeply they loved their country, and how pleased they were that some of their knowledge of it would be preserved and made public, subject to a set of clearly defined restrictions which have not and shall never be violated. At their urging and with their permission, This book is theirs, a gift from them to the grandchildren of Sibikyu, and to their grandchildren, and to theirs. Other Apache people who have taken time to instruct me and show me how to behave include Lola McCuse, to whom I am particularly grateful, Ruth Patterson, Annie Peaches, Dick Cooley, Calvert and Darlene Tesse, Esther Lupe, Rose Thompson, Ernest Murphy, Joe Case, Sam and Lillian Johnson, Charles Cromwell, Sam Enfield, Levi DeHose, Lonnie DeHose, Francis and Sarah DeHose, Nelson Lupe Sr., Roy and Nanny Quay, Teddy Peaches, Alvin Quay, Irvin Quay, Imogen Quay, Emily Quay, Simon and Beverly Enfield, Virgil and Judy DeHose, Delmar Bonney, Vincent Randall, Ned Anderson, Philip Cassadore, Ola Cassadore Davis, Marlo Cassadore, and Franklin Stanley. I am also indebted to Nashley Tesse Sr., who helped me no end in translating the stories and place names which appear in the pages to follow, Ronnie Lupe, chairman of the White Mountain Apache tribe, for more than 20 years, has been constant in his encouragement, guidance, and advice. Working with him, as with everyone else, has been an honor and a privilege. I am also thankful for my friendship with Wayne and Flora Cole. My mother, Atolia S. Basso, has helped in many ways. My wife, Gail Porter Basso, has helped in many more. Her resilient heart and critical mind saw this project through, especially on those occasions when my spirits headed south. To Gail, with love, and to W. Now, it's pretty good. Ow. Keith H. Basso, Heber, Arizona, 1995. 1. Quoting the Ancestors. Place is the first of all beings, since everything that exists is in a place, and cannot exist without a place. Archytas, as cited by Simplicius, Commentary on Aristotle's Categories. If, as L.P. Hartley proposed, the past is a foreign country, they do things differently there. He added, to make the point, it is everywhere a land that attracts its share of visitors, and understandably so. Passage to the past is easy to come by. Any reminder of bygone times can serve to launch an excursion. Getting there is quick and efficient. A quiet moment or two is usually sufficient to make the transition, and restrictions on local travel are virtually non-existent. Memory and imagination, the most intimate and inventive of traveling companions, always see to that. And however the trip unfolds, one can proceed at an undemanding pace, exploring sites of special interest or moving about from place to place without feeling harried or rushed. Which may account for the fact that returning abruptly to the country of the present, where things are apt to be rushed enough, is often somewhat jarring. Just where one ventures in the country of the past sometimes depends on where one has ventured before, on personal predilections nurtured over time, for congenial pieces of experiential terrain, the terrain of one's youth, perhaps, or of where one's forebears lived, or of decisive events that alter the course of history. The possibilities are endless. Yet, whatever these preferences are, and no matter how often indulged, the past has a way of luring curious travelers off the beaten track. It is, after all, a country conducive to wandering, with plenty of unmarked roads, unexpected vistas, and unforeseen occurrences. Informative discoveries, pleasurable and otherwise, are not at all uncommon. which is why it can seem, as William Chapman has written, that the past is at its best when it takes us to places that counsel and instruct, that show us who we are by showing us where we have been, that reminds us of our connections to what happened here, and why it is as well. For the same set of reasons that this ever-changing landscape of the active heart and mind rewards repeated visits. For wherever one journeys in the country of the past, instructive places abound. Many of these places are also encountered in the country of the present as material objects and areas, naturally formed or built, whose myriad local arrangements make up the landscapes of everyday life. But here, now, in the ongoing world of current concerns and projects, they are not apprehended as reminders of the past. Instead, when accorded attention at all, places are perceived in terms of their outward aspects, as being, on their manifest surfaces, the familiar places they are. And, unless something happens to dislodge these perceptions, they are left, as it were, to their own enduring devices. But then, something does happen. Perhaps one spots a freshly fallen tree, or a bit of flaking paint, or a house where none has stood before. Any disturbance, large or small, that inscribes the passage of time, and a place presents itself as bearing on prior events. And at that precise moment, when ordinary perceptions begin to loosen their hold, a border has been crossed and the country starts to change. Awareness has shifted its footing, and the character of the place, now transfigured by thoughts of an earlier day, swiftly takes on a new and foreign look. Consider in this regard the remarks of Niels Bohr, the great theoretical physicist, while speaking in June of 1924 with Werner Heisenberg at Kronborg Castle in Denmark, Bohr's beloved homeland. Isn't it strange how this castle changes as soon as one imagines that Hamlet lived here? As scientists, we believe that a castle consists only of stones and admire the way the architect put them together. The stone, the green roof with its patina, the wood carvings in the church constitute the whole castle. None of this should be changed by the fact that Hamlet lived here, and yet it is changed completely. Suddenly the walls and ramparts speak a different language. The courtyard becomes an entire world. A dark corner reminds us of the darkness of the human soul. We hear Hamlet's to be or not to be, yet all we really know is that his name appears in a 13th century chronicle. No one can prove he really lived here. But everyone knows the questions Shakespeare had him ask. The human depths he was made to reveal, and so he too had to be found in a place on earth, here in Kronborg. And once we know that, Kronborg becomes a quite different castle for us. Thus, by one insightful account, does the country of the past transform and supplant the country of the present. That certain localities prompt such transformations, evoking as they do entire worlds of meaning, is not, as Niels Bohr recognized, a small or uninteresting truth. Neither is the fact, which he also appreciated, that this type of retrospective world-building, let us call it place-making, does not require special sensibilities or cultivated skills. It is a common response to common curiosities. What happened here? Who was involved? What was it like? Why should it matter? And anyone can be a placemaker who has the inclination. And every so often, more or less spontaneously, alone or with others, with varying degrees of interest and enthusiasm, almost everyone does make places. As roundly ubiquitous as it is seemingly unremarkable, placemaking is a universal tool of the historical imagination, and in some societies at least, if not the great majority, it is surely among the most basic tools of all. Prevalent though it is, this type of world-building is never entirely simple. On the contrary, a modest body of evidence suggests that placemaking involves multiple acts of remembering and imagining, which inform each other in complex ways. It is clear, however, that remembering often provides a basis for imagining. What is remembered about a particular place, including, prominently, verbal and visual accounts of what has transpired there, guides and constrains how it will be imagined by delimiting a field of workable possibilities. These possibilities are then exploited by acts of conjecture and speculation, which build upon them and go beyond them to create possibilities of a new and original sort, thus producing a fresh and expanded picture of how things might have been. Essentially, then, instances of placemaking consist in an adventitious fleshing out of historical material that culminates in a posited state of affairs, a particular universe of objects and events, in short, a place world wherein portions of the past are brought into being. When Niels Bohr went with Heisenberg to visit Kronborg Castle, he thought instantly of Hamlet and recalled the famous play in which this figure comes to life. Then, seizing on possibilities inherent in Shakespeare's drama, Bohr went on to imagine a darkly compelling place world in which the walls of the castle echoed an alien tongue. A shaded courtyard nook gave notice of the troubled human soul, and Hamlet uttered his anguished cry, "To be or not to be." And probably, considering it was Bohr, there was much more besides. Other fancied elements wrought in compatible terms which endowed his somber place world with added substance and depth. Within this foreign universe, Bohr could briefly dwell, and until it started to fade, as every place world must, the imaginative Danish physicist and a bit of Danish history breathed life into each other. But there is more to making place worlds than living local history in a localized kind of way. In addition, placemaking is a way of constructing history itself, of inventing it, of fashioning novel versions of what happened here. For every developed place world manifests itself as a possible state of affairs, and whenever these constructions are accepted by other people as credible and convincing, or plausible and provocative, or arresting and intriguing, they enrich the common stock on which everyone can draw to muse on past events, interpret their significance, and imagine them anew. Building and sharing place worlds, in other words, is not only a means of reviving former times, but also of revising them. A means of exploring not merely how things might have been, but also how, just possibly, they might have been different from what others have supposed. Augmenting and enhancing conceptions of the past, innovative place worlds change these conceptions as well. By way of illustration, and returning once more to Denmark, Bohr's remarks to Heisenberg could have provided Heisenberg with novel possibilities for building his own version of Hamlet's castle in Hamlet's time, a place world that would have been different from any he might have fashioned working by himself. And if Heisenberg had then returned the favor, describing in some detail his own construction to Bohr, the same would be true in reverse, which is simply to say that discussing the stuff of place worlds, comparing their contents, pursuing their implications, assessing their strengths and weaknesses, is a regular social process as common and straightforward as it is sometimes highly inventive. In this discursive fashion, even in societies where writing and other devices for preserving the past are absent or devalued, historical knowledge is produced and reproduced. And in this manner, too, even in societies which lack the services of revisionary historians, historical understandings are altered and recast. It is well to keep in mind that interpreting the past can be readily accomplished, and is every day, without recourse to documentary archives, photographic files, and early sound recordings. It cannot be accomplished readily or otherwise without recourse to places and the place worlds they engender. Long before the advent of literacy, to say nothing of history, as an academic discipline, places served mankind as durable symbols of distant events and as indispensable aids for remembering and imagining them. And this convenient arrangement, ancient but not outmoded, is with us still today. In modern landscapes everywhere, people persist in asking, what happened here? The answers they supply, though perhaps distinctly foreign, should not be taken lightly, for what people make of their places is closely connected to what they make of themselves as members of society and inhabitants of the earth. And while the two activities may be separable in principle, they are deeply joined in practice. If placemaking is a way of constructing the past, a venerable means of doing human history, it is also a way of constructing social traditions and, in the process, personal and social identities. We are, in a sense, the place worlds we imagine. But these and related matters are only broadly discerned and loosely understood, and the main reason why is easy to identify. A widespread form of imaginative activity, placemaking, is also a form of cultural activity, and so, as any anthropologist will tell you, it can be grasped only in relation to the ideas and practices with which it is accomplished. And because these ideas and practices may vary considerably both within and among particular social groups, the nature of the activity can be understood only by means of sustained ethnography. Yet little ethnography of placemaking has in fact been undertaken, and what is known about placemaking, Navajo or Norwegian, Sinhalese or Soviet, Mexican or Moroccan, is therefore sharply limited. There is work to be done, and now is as good a time as any to see what it may involve. This chapter, which offers an example of the work I have in mind, is soon to cross over the border into an American Indian version of Hartley's Foreign Land. The time has come to travel, first to Arizona, and to the village of Cibicue, home since the beginning to groups of men and women known to themselves as Nde, people, to others as Western Apache, and then to some of their places not far away, places with names such as Widow's Pause for Breath, She Carries Her Brother on Her Back, and Bitter Agave Plain. Places made memorable and infinitely imaginable by events that happened long ago when the people's distant ancestors were settling into the country. So let us be off, stopping here and there with one Charles Henry, age 60 or thereabouts, skilled herbalist, devoted uncle, and veteran maker of place worlds. Niels Bohr, I like to think, would have enjoyed his company. For both men understood, though in very different ways, that castles come in a great many shapes and need not to be wrought with mortar and stone. Water lies with mud in an open container. Early morning, late May 1979, the night's redemptive chill rapidly receding before the rising sun. Silence, deep and full. a blanket upon the land. I am standing with Charles Henry and one of his cousins, Morley Cromwell, at the edge of a circular swale some 40 feet across, ringed by willows and filled with luxuriant grasses. It lies near a spring-fed creek which flows southeast to the gardens and cornfields of Cibecue. The earth at our feet is marked with the tracks of deer, and from high in a cottonwood tree comes the liquid call of a raven. A chipmunk creeps to the swale, secures a nervous drink, and darts away behind a rotting log covered with patches of green and orange moss. The air is heavy and moist. A small white butterfly dances in place in a shaft of golden sunlight. Charles and Morley have brought me here at the outset of a long-range project in Western Apache cultural geography, authorized and endorsed by the White Mountain Apache Tribal Council. The project's main objective is to record on topographic maps the approximate location of each and every place that bears an Apache name within a 20-mile radius of the Cibecue community. Residents of the community have never known maps they considered their own. Those in their possession show but a handful of places with extraneous names in English and Spanish. And the work we have started, which is intended to lay the foundation for a local Apache atlas, is regarded by some as long overdue. A couple of weeks ago, before the work began, the three of us agreed on a simple division of labor. Charles, who is in charge, will guide us from place to place, supply each place's proper name, and comment as he chooses on its past and present significance. Morley will translate as necessary. Charles speaks English reluctantly, and my own Apache is stiff and uneven at best, and offer additional insights. My job is to drive the Jeep, provide plenty of coffee and Reese's peanut butter cups, Morley has a serious weakness for them, and try to get everything down on paper and audio tapes. It seems like a sensible plan, balanced and loosely efficient, and all of us believe it will serve our purpose well. But already, on only our second day in the country together, a problem has come up. For the third time in as many tries, I have mispronounced the Apache name of the boggy swale before us, and Charles, who is wary of repeating it, has a guarded look in his eyes. After botching the name a fourth time, I acknowledge defeat and attempt to apologize for my flawed linguistic performance. "I'm sorry, Charles. I can't get it. I'll work on it later. It's in the machine. It doesn't matter." "It's matter," Charles says softly to me in English, and then, turning to speak to Morley, he addresses him in Western Apache. "What he's doing isn't right. It's not good. He seems to be in a hurry. Why is he in a hurry? It's disrespectful. Our ancestors made this name. They made it just as it is. They made it for a reason. They spoke it first a long time ago. He's repeating the speech of our ancestors." "He doesn't know that. Tell him he's repeating the speech of our ancestors." Charles's admonition, which Morley proceeds to translate without dulling its critical edge, leaves me unsettled and silent. That Charles has taken me for someone in a hurry comes as a surprise. Neither had I foreseen that my failure to pronounce the stubborn Apache place name would be interpreted by him as displaying a lack of respect. And never had I suspected that using Apache place names might be heard by those who use them as repeating verbatim, actually quoting the speech of their early ancestors. This is a fair amount to take in at once. And as the quiet of the morning asserts itself again, I fear that my actions, which were wholly unwitting but patently offensive, may have placed in jeopardy the future of our project. Charles and Morley, put off by my incompetence, may now decide they have better things to do. Damn it. But then, unexpectedly, in one of those courteous turnabouts that Apache people employ to assuage embarrassment and salvage damaged feelings, Charles himself comes to the rescue. With a quick, corroborative grin, he announces he is missing several teeth, and that my problem with the place name may be attributable to his lack of dental equipment. Sometimes, he says, he is hard to understand. His nephew Jason recently told him that, and he knows he tends to speak softly. Maybe the combination of too few teeth and too little volume accounts for my falling short. Morley, on the other hand, is not so encumbered. Though shy a tooth or two, he retains the good ones for talking, and because he is not afraid to speak up, except, as everyone knows, in the presence of garrulous women, no one has trouble hearing what he says. Maybe if Morley repeated the place name again, slowly and with ample force, I would get it right. It's worth a try. Cousin, gostolish tu, viu, sikani. Rising to the spirit of Charles's playful teasing, Morley booms out the place name, word by constituent word, with such exuberance as to startle into flight a pair of resonant robins. All of us laugh as the birds wheel away, but for me the tide is turned. Instantly, the form of the name and its meaning assume coherent shape, and I know that at last I've got it. Gosht lish tu, bil sikane, or water lies with mud in an open container. Relieved and pleased, I pronounce the name slowly, then a bit more rapidly, and again as it might be spoken in normal conversation. Charles listens and nods his head in approval. Yes, he says in Apache. That is how our ancestors made it a long time ago, just as it is to name this place. And then, keeping to his own language and speaking at times like an observer on the scene, he fashions a place world in which the making and naming occurred. They came to this country long ago, our ancestors did. They hadn't seen it before. They knew nothing about it. Everything was unfamiliar to them. They were very poor. They had few possessions, and surviving was difficult for them. They were looking for a good place to settle, a safe place without enemies. They were searching. They were traveling all over, stopping here and there, noticing everything, looking at the land. They knew nothing about it, and didn't know what they would find. None of these places had names then, none of them did, and as the people went about, they thought about this. How shall we speak about this land? They said. How shall we speak about where we have been and where we want to go? Now they are coming. They are walking upstream from down below. Now they are arriving here, looking all about them, noticing everything about this place. It looked to them then as it looks to us now. We know that from its name gives a picture of it, just as it was a long time ago. Now they are happy. This looks like a good place. They are saying to each other, now they are noticing the plants that live around here. Some of these plants are unknown to us. Maybe they are good for something. Maybe they are useful as medicines. Now they are saying, this is a good place for hunting. Deer and turkey come here to eat and drink. We can wait for them here, hidden close by. They're saying that. They are noticing everything and talking about it together. They like what they see about this place. They are excited. Now their leader is thinking, this place may help us survive. If we settle in this country, we must be able to speak about this place and remember it clearly and well. We must give it a name. So, they named it Goshtlishtu Bil Sikane. Water lies with mud in an open container. They made a picture of it with words. Now they could speak about it and remember it clearly as well. Now they had a picture they could carry in their minds. You can see for yourself. It looks like its name. When Charles has finished speaking, he reaches down and takes from the marshy ground a heaping handful of mud. He squeezes it firmly, causing little jets of water to spurt from between his fingers. There, he says with evident satisfaction, water and mud together, just as they were when our ancestors came here. He then excuses himself, explaining that he needs to procure a certain medicinal plant for use in his work at Sibiku. He will not be gone long and will join us back at the jeep. Walking along with Morley, I cannot contain my appreciation for all that Charles has said. That was great, I exclaim. It's like we were there, watching them when they came. Morley concurs, adding matter-of-factly that Charles is a vigorous thinker and has done this sort of thing on numerous occasions. Do you think he'll do it again? I ask. It's up to him, says Morley. I think he probably will. Snake's Water. It turns out Morley is right. In the slow-moving week that follows, June is now upon us, the heat a relentless foe. We travel with Charles to 12 more places, and at 2 of these, an open expanse named Nada Nch I Gogaye, Bitter Agave Plain, and a dispersion of vertical boulders called Tse Nadadan Aha, Scattered Rocks Stand Erect. He slips into the past and constructs ancestral place worlds. Much as before, and speaking often in the same eyewitness voice, he imagines his forebears arriving on the scene, studying it intently, and assessing its potential for helping them survive. Looking out on Bitter Agave Plain, the ancestors marvel at all the grass, tall and thick and laden with edible seeds, and praise it as a sign of ample summer rainfall. Pausing at scattered rocks stand erect, they wonder, with a mixture of fear and curiosity, why the boulders are upright, as if rammed into the earth by some gigantic hand. At both localities, they make and bestow a place name, a name describing the place itself, just as it looked a long time ago, just as it looks today, and Charles, having lodged himself in the present again, says that much is contained in Apache place names, preserving as they do both the words of his ancestors and their graphic impressions of an unfamiliar land. But more is contained in Apache place names than frozen ancestral quotes and ageless images of a new and striking landscape. In addition, place names can offer evidence of changes in the landscape, showing clearly that certain localities do not present the appearance they did in former times. More interesting still, some of this evidence points to major shifts in local climatic patterns, thus allowing inferences to be drawn about how and possibly why the environment of the ancestors differed in key respects from that of their modern descendants. And were this not enough, the theme of places changing even as they endure sometimes find expression in gripping Apache place worlds. I knew nothing of these things until I accompanied Charles and Morley to Tishbe Tue, Snake's Water, an inactive spring at the foot of a sandstone bluff some miles west of Sibiku. Hidden from view by manzanita bushes, the spring is survived by a cluster of hand-cut rocks, flat and rectilinear, which encircle a pool of whitish sand now the home of delicate purple wildflowers and a motley assortment of weeds. A Budweiser beer can, faded and pockmarked with rust, lies on the ground nearby. Standing alone a few feet away, Charles gazes at the rocks for several minutes, as though waiting for them to speak, and perhaps somehow they do, for he suddenly declares that the spring has long been dry, that at some point in time its water went away, and that the result of this is an absence of fit. A lack of match, is what he says in Apache, between the place itself and the way its name describes it. The name it was given a long time ago shows that it has changed. Snake's Water, as anyone can see, is no longer the way it was when the ancestors saw it first and made it their own with words. Motionless, in denim shirt and sweat-stained Stetson hat, Charles again falls silent. Then, with his eyes still fixed on the barren circle of rocks, he begins to fashion a place world in which they served an important purpose. Now these rocks are lying alone. No one comes to them anymore. Once, this wasn't so. Long ago, people came here often. They squatted on these rocks when they filled their containers with water. They knelt on these rocks when they drank water from their hands. Our people were very grateful for this spring. It made them happy to know they could rely on it any time. They were glad this place was here. Now they are coming to get water. They have been working. Maybe they were digging up agave, and now they are thirsty. A man is walking in the lead with women and children behind him. The women are carrying their containers. Some have water jugs on their backs. No one is talking. Maybe there are snakes here, lying on these rocks. Yes. Now the man in front can see them. There are snakes lying stretched out on these rocks. They are the ones who own this spring, the ones who protect it. Now that man is speaking to the people. Listen to me, he is saying. All of you must wait here. Don't go any closer. Don't approach Snake's Water until I talk to them and ask them to move away. The people obey this man, knowing that he will do things correctly. Now they are waiting together in a group, just as he told them to do. Now that man has come here. He is talking to those who protect Snake's Water, using words they understand and doing things correctly. Soon, they move off the rocks. They keep going, unalarmed, until they are out of sight. Now that man is sprinkling something on the water. It is a gift to the ones who own it. He is giving thanks to them and water, informing them that he and the people are grateful. This is good, he is saying to them. This is good. Now he is beckoning to the people to come and get water. Some of them are still concerned, holding back with their children. Others are arriving now, nervously looking around. Now they see they have nothing to fear. Everything was done correctly, and they start to fill their containers. Now they are happy and grateful, talking amongst themselves. This water is good, they are saying. It is good that it is here for us. Some of the women are smiling. They know they have nothing to fear. Now they are kneeling on these stones, relieving their thirst, drinking from their hands. Charles says no more. There is nothing to be said. The three of us turn from the barren spring and together walk slowly away, lost in thought and the deepness of time, sojourners still in a distant world that cast a powerful spell. A short while later, seated in the shade of a juniper tree, Charles explains that what we observed at Snake's Water is not at all uncommon. There are more places like it, scattered throughout Apache country, that have undergone physical changes and no longer conform to the way their names describe them. Many of these places, he says, were named for sources of water, springs, seeps, bogs, seasonal pools at the bases of canyon walls, which now